geeks and cinemaniacs. From the heart of Hollyweird, California, at the epicenter of all things eerie and awesome, it's time for Charles Band's Full Moon Freak Show.
Welcome back to my Freak Show. Last week, I had the chance to sit down with my friend Mick Garris, the writer, director, and producer behind such classic entertainments as Stephen King's Sleepwalkers and The Stand, as well as TV's Master of Horror. And now, let's dive back in for the second part of that epic chat. Once more, here's Mick. Let's go back to your relationship with Stephen King. So to me, that's really exciting.
Well, it started with Sleepwalkers. Okay. And it came in a roundabout way through Psycho 4.
Oh, really? Wow.
My agent got a meeting set up for me with the people at Columbia who were doing Sleepwalkers. It was his first original screenplay, based on a book or IP. So I had this great lunch meeting with the executives at Columbia, and at the end of the meeting they said, "We think you're a perfect fit. We think the script needs some work, so it's great that you're a writer as well as a director."
This was after, obviously, Critters and Psycho 4.
Yeah, this was 1992. Yeah.
Were those your credits kind of going into this meeting?
Yeah.
The director of Critters 2 and Psycho 4.
And writer for Batteries Not Included and Fly 2 and writing for Steven Spielberg.
Right.
That opened every
That's the
door.
Good stuff. Yeah.
So it was a great meeting. I knew my King really well from Passion, not from Homework. Mm-hmm. And so they said, "We just have to do another meeting with another director because his agent and we have a very good relationship and we need to see it through." So they hired the other director. And he started rewriting Stephen King, completely changing the script. And if you have a movie called Stephen King's Sleepwalkers with no Stephen King in it, that's not going to go.
Wow.
And he's not going to let his name go on it. So it went so far afield that they had the literal creative differences, decided not to go that way. I got a call to come back and have lunch with one of the producers.
Wow.
And I thought I was going to have to repitch again and all this stuff. And so we had a great lunch. And at the end of the lunch, he said, "So let's move you into your office." So that day, I was hired and moved into a production office.
Oh, my goodness. And what a great story. What a typical Hollywood story, too. It's just so Hollywood.
Atypical in a lot of ways, but, you know. But that movie went so well, and King was so happy with the movie that he recommended me. Well, he had director approval, and he was sent a movie by this other
But by now you're communicating with him. You're
Once I'm in production, in pre-production. Mm-hmm. But before that, he wasn't really involved, but he saw these two movies. One was a TV movie by this other director, and the other was Psycho 4. And he thought, "Oh, God, Psycho with a 4 in the title." And he was so happy that it was so much better than a movie with a 4 in the title has the right to be that he approved me. And we only met once during the production.
Once. Because did he come out here? Did you go out to see him?
He came out. We shot in town.
That was the first time you had met him, but you had talked to him prior.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm a crazy fan.
Well,
so,
me too.
I know. Yeah. So tell us about this meeting with Stephen. First, you must have been a little nervous.
I was very nervous. Right. And the morning he was coming out to do his cameo with Tobe Hooper and Clive Barker. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that morning at Craft Services, eating my morning granola, I broke my tooth. Oh. And I had to have an emergency cap put on. I got to get back in time because King's only going to be there for 2 hours.
Oh, my God.
And the whole time was spent directing. You know, they rushed me back with a temporary cap on my tooth and crown on my tooth.
Right.
And he came in and he was there literally 2 hours. We did this whole scene in one shot where it starts with him, then it includes Clive Barker, then it goes to Tobe Hooper, and it moves off of them and the scene continues. So you could cut that and not affect the story
in any way.
But you know, gobble gobble one of us. We know who that is.
Right.
And the fans know. Mm-hmm. So I really got to know him over
the phone. So you had no moment during that madness to actually sit and
not much.
Just like
a few minutes, but it was all madness literally. And I introduced him to Toby Hooper, whom he'd never met before, and Clive Barker, whose career he made by giving a blurb to Clive's first Books of Blood. I have seen the future of horror, and his name is Clive Barker.
Famous quote.
Yeah, and it made Clive's career in the States. So really, it was talking over the phone during pre-production, which we did regularly. And then when the studio would be insistent about some issues for rewrite, I would say, do you want me to do it? And he said, well, let me give it a crack. And the next morning, there'd be six great pages in the fax machine.
Wow. You know,
it was an amazingly good experience.
Oh, my God.
And he's a great, generous, wonderful guy.
He's awesome. You know, I've never met him. We may have exchanged letters in the 80s. I don't remember, but whatever it is, I'm such a fan. And he's just led such a wonderful life too. You know, he's a real dude. He's not in this town. He has on purpose.
Yeah.
For sure. And he's just, I don't think there's anyone like him. You can't think of another writer aside from his insane success worldwide. I mean,
The best selling author of all time. I believe.
But he's, you know, it's important how you live your life too, and your family, and I mean, the whole thing is.
I'll tell you, I'm a super fan. He's the most down to earth, non rich, rich guy I've ever met. When I first met him to screen him my cut of Sleepwalkers at Magno in New York, this screening room in New York, he was wearing blown out tennies and busted jeans, and was having lunch at McDonald's and stuff like that.
That's great.
He's so genuine and so smart. And because I've worked with him so much, a lot of people think I'm his bitch, that I do his bidding, you know?
I wouldn't think. No, you're his
collaborator. A lot of people think, he just does what Steve wants. But the fact is, he's never once suggested how to do anything in a scene, how to shoot anything. I go to him and ask, what greater resource could a filmmaker have than Stephen King? But, he's really a great guy to give you the rope to hang yourself with.
And then I think you told me when I did your podcast that he was your first guest. Am I wrong or right?
Not my first guest. It took us like three, 4 years to get him.
Okay, I'm completely misinformed. So who was your first guest?
First guest was Rob Zombie.
Oh, who was literally 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. And who's a great guy.
Great guy.
And he and I are both vegans, and we get along on that end of things. And having been a rock and roller myself in early days.
Now, his career is also extraordinary.
Yeah, I really like him.
Super cool guy, and we had so much fun. We went on and on. It wound up being a two-parter, but we've gotten a great response. All right, so Stephen King. Now, how did that all segue into making The Shining, which was a trip just to begin with, because it's a TV adaptation of a movie that was already
well-known. Iconic. But first we did The Stand, which to this day is the most successful miniseries
history. Sorry, I got him twisted.
It's fine. So because we'd had such a good time together on Sleepwalkers.
Right.
And I'd never done anything of a large scale before, and The Stand is as big as it
gets.
Huge,
I know.
So it was entirely new to me. But he came to me because he had director approval on that and asked me if I wanted to do it.
I thought
for 10 seconds, well, it's TV and I'm trying to make a feature career. And then it was like, it's The fucking Stand.
Right. And it's Stephen King.
And we worked together
so happily.
I'm glad
it took you only 10 seconds.
Yeah. Me too. But that became such a huge success that ABC said to him, what do you want to do next?
Right.
And he said, I want to do The Shining. I want to tell the story of the book.
Wow.
And of course,
talk about pressure on the director.
Well, yes and no. I mean, there was tremendous pressure, but because we were intentionally not working in the shadow of Stanley Kubrick, you know, when the Kubrick movie came out, I'd read the book and I never wanted to see a movie more than I wanted to see. I mean, King and Kubrick, how could you blow that? And like the critics of the day, I was hugely disappointed because it's not the book.
Right.
And I always say, King is warm and Kubrick is cold. And The Shining as a novel is all about the father's guilt that his alcoholism led him to break his young son's arm. Yeah. And it doesn't really play a part in the Kubrick film. Mm-hmm. So what I learned is it's a great Kubrick film. Mm-hmm. It's not a great adaptation of Stephen King.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I would agree with that. Tough one, though.
Yeah, but...
Because I'm an incredible fan of both of them. It's bummer that the PR later and the whatever they had and the issues back and forth.
Well, in fact, as part of making the deal, for some reason, Kubrick owned the rights rather than Warner Brothers.
Oh, really?
Or at least had to be paid.
Control those rights or something, right.
He was paid $1.5 million for us to have the rights. And just part of the deal was that King could not talk about his opinion of Kubrick's film.
No way.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was part of the deal.
Is that common knowledge now, kind of? Because
it is now. It is right as of
now,
today on your
flash,
show.
Man.
Yeah, you got an exclusive.
Interesting. Okay. But anyway, so you did the stand first.
Did the stand first.
How many weeks or months did you shoot?
It was a 100-day shoot. So we shot for 5 months, and pre-production was 2 months, and then another 5 months of post. So it was a full year.
Wow.
It was a full year away from home. And
where did you shoot it?
We shot it primarily in Salt Lake City and around Utah.
But we shot
in six states. We shot scenes in California, scenes in New York, and in Ogunquit, Maine. You know, we shot all over the place.
So I would imagine, looking back, and I'm being complete. This is without any knowledge.
No,
it's just
for
a guess. That probably is one of your better memories of making a movie, that adventure, because you were, when was this, the 90?
It was 93. We shot it. It came out in 94.
Right. Think of it. That's hard to believe almost 30 years ago.
Yeah, next year. Yeah.
But that must have been a great adventure for
you. It was fantastic, but it's also the hardest work I've ever done in my life.
Okay.
Because for the first 13 weeks, there were five-day weeks, but they're all on location. We did some stage work.
Right.
But the weather was never right. The days were excruciatingly long.
Right.
And then the last 7 weeks were six-day weeks. Six-day weeks are really seven-day weeks. You got to do your homework and your laundry and try and do that. But it was nonstop work for a year, and the hours were excruciatingly long. The scenes were difficult to shoot. You know, Las Vegas, we're shooting 600 extras.
That's
and
incredible.
I'd never had more than like
huge.
30. Yeah, but we shot it on 16 millimeter.
What?
To save money.
Oh, no.
Laurel Entertainment said, no, we're going to shoot it on 16.
I did not know
well,
that.
Well, because it was for television,
but
there would be no projected version. So it would be directly transferred
by the
to
90s,
video.
People were pretty on top of the quality, the longevity, the library.
Yeah.
That is a weird decision.
Well, it led to a lot of choices of what the lenses were going to be and not using a lot of diffusion or anything because the grain would be amplified quadrupled.
Wow.
But it turned out to be a plus because I carried a Steadicam as well as a hothead crane every day.
Okay.
So we didn't have time to lay down track, but we had a great Steadicam operator who didn't have to lug.
Right.
You know, the weight of the equipment really helped us speed us along.
Yeah, but today in the world of 4K and everything else, you probably think, fuck, 16 millimeter.
Amazingly, a couple of years ago, CBS Paramount did a Blu-ray, and I never thought it would see Blu-ray because it was never, you know, it was standard def.
Right.
There was never a negative cut or anything. Mm-hmm. It was all just video.
Oh, right. Oh, that's even worse.
They went back to the negative, reconformed. It's in HD. It looks better than ever. It's beautiful.
Okay, I'm going to have to find that and watch that.
And the sound is great, too. They did a really good job.
People don't want to be bored about the technical side of
this,
but there was a period where I was the last holdout. I shot everything on 35 until finally people said, you are really stupid. You can't do this anymore. It cost and budgets were shrinking. But there was a period towards the end of that where instead of shooting on 35 and cutting negative, which I did going back to 72 or 3, you would shoot on negative and go right to tape, basically, and edit on tape.
Yep.
But now, since we go back, and a lot of these movies are in my weird world, well known. You want to go back and you want to do a Blu-ray, you want to do whatever. You got to go back, take all your negative. Luckily, we shot very little. It's like 3-to-1 ratio. But still, you got to take 30,000 feet of film, put it on. Then you got to match cut all that stuff.
And then the issue is once
you've done that, then there's some effects usually in these movies, which were CGI, not CGI, strike that. They were composite. They were effects 30 years ago. So then you had to, how do you do that? You have to kind of do a faux similar effect in CGI. Anyway, it's, I hate that period. And you had that for the Stand in 16 millimeter. Well, you must have shot a million feet of film.
It was
easily.
I have no idea.
No, you shot a lot of film.
I shot for 5 months.
5 months.
Every day, you know, we did a lot of work.
To put it in perspective, our little shows now, and we do pretty well in, with our limited budget, you know, they probably average 65, 70 minutes, so the running time has shrunk. But we're in the we're in a streaming age, and if you know, if you tell an entertaining tale in an hour, people are happy. It's not like, oh, it's, you know, we couldn't get into Blockbuster in Hollywood in the 80s and 90s without at least 75, 80 minutes.
Right.
You know, so the
then
world,
it's a feature.
Yeah,
then I it's don't a think you can get an Oscar if it's under 75.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, I'm not planning on any.
Oh,
Oscars.
Come on.
Maybe accumulatively, but anyway, the average shooting time for us, you know, and again, we're usually one location shoots and the directors are very well trained and about 6 days, 7 days.
Wow.
That's what we do.
That's
six,
fast.
7 days.
Yeah. Well, this was one.
Well, we also
days.
Have the benefit. You didn't have that 30 years ago of light equipment and the lights get thrown. I mean, we can move very quickly.
And
so
you don't
you
have
shot
to change mags.
5 months.
Yeah.
And let's just say they're all 6 day weeks. So you have
100 days of shooting.
Yeah. So that would be 17 of our movies. I'm just trying to do the math.
And it was, you know, it was 8 hours on television, but without commercials and news breaks and stuff, it was 6 hours, like on the Blu-ray.
6 hours.
6 hours.
Wow.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's a mind blower. So then we segue in, because I want to get to Masters of Horror before we go into hour three, because I love talking to you about all this stuff. But then
Then The Shining.
Then The Shining.
Yeah. And that came about, King. Well, everybody was happy with The Stand.
That's great.
You know,
and
the
it was
reviews
a huge
were great.
That's
it was
great. That's great.
The biggest viewership of any miniseries.
You know,
in
I'm jumping in again here because for people who weren't around, like most of this audience, close to 30 years ago, unlike today, you can binge, you can do, you can record, you can not too long, you can TiVo. Back then, that episode would come out at 8 o'clock or whatever. You had to be there. There was no.
Or you could use a VCR.
Yeah, but still, it was an event.
Yeah.
I mean, we were there. Dinner.
You'd watch it live.
You would watch it live. You didn't want to watch it later, or hear someone say something, or tape it. And
so we would have 50 million people watching on a night.
Think of that.
Yeah, and I'd never had any. You know, Sleepwalkers came out. It was number one at the box office for 1 week.
Right.
And that's a big success.
It is.
But that's not like everybody. You know, I would be in supermarket lines and hear people talking about The Stand.
Oh, it was a happening.
It
was a happening.
Yeah, and it has remained, you know, really popular. The recent Blu-ray was a huge success for them.
Right.
And,
who was in it, just to refresh all of our memories?
Okay, it was Gary Sinise and Rob Lowe, Ruby Davis, Ruby D, Ossie Davis, Matt Frewer, Molly Ringwald.
I remember that.
Yeah,
great cast.
It was amazing. And Ruby D and Ossie Davis and Gary Sinise, I mean, and Ray Walston. Such high-end, regaled people, you know, these actors.
You've had the, I mean, I've worked with a few, I've worked with many wonderful actors, but a few, because at that time, I mean, like Gary Sinise, these are, I wouldn't call them superstars, but they're extremely well-known.
This made him, you know, Bob Zemeckis hired him for Forrest Gump off of that.
Oh, really?
That's where his career really
interesting.
Happened.
Okay, well, another amazing movie. So when you're directing actors like that, I mean, I know the hardship and the long hours and the 1 year, but it's got to be such a thrill. Because
it's a thrill. Some of them don't need or want it. Some of it want to know. Want the encouragement because, as you know, we're on the outside and they're on the inside.
Right.
And you learn really quickly every actor has a different approach.
Right.
And you learn, who do I shoot the close-up first, and who wears out quickly,
and who
needs to ramp up to turn around on the other actor.
And who's best on that first take.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, people like that, it was such an honor. And it was intimidating, but you can't seem intimidated.
But no, never.
But it's always...
No. Yeah.
But my way of filmmaking, as I'm sure is yours, is through encouragement.
Always.
You know?
And they need it. I don't care how, you know, experienced. You know, people need to be told that is awesome. I mean, I've always done that. My sets are some thousands who've worked on all these movies. Very calm, chill, warm. I mean, yelling and screaming, and none of that accomplishes anything.
People do that. The cast and crew are going to do the least they can get away with for somebody that they don't want. You know, you want everybody to feel like they're doing something special.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the blessing and the curse of hiring a first-time director, which I've done plenty of, including Stuart Gordon, is, you know, from a business point of view, logically, you need someone on these small movies who needs to know what they're doing. You need a craftsman who comes in, who's done it before. Okay, but the first-time director doesn't have that experience, so you take a gamble.
And you need a good line producer.
Well, you need a good everything. Yeah. You need a team surrounding that person. Yeah. But it's still, you don't know. You know, you don't know if they're going to be worried about the coolest shot ever, even though you can talk to them and get a sense, or they're going to be more into the performances, which is all I care about. You know, forget all the fancy shots.
You're telling a story.
You're telling a story. And in these little smaller movies, it has got to be a character-driven piece. It can't be relying on, you know, blood and guts and silliness. So I've had good and bad.
You need a Tim Thomerson.
You know, I should tell the story, but I can't resist because it's embarrassing for me. But so looking back, a lot of the movies I made, I'm happy with. Trancers was one of my favorite.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm making Trancers, the first Trancers, with Tim Thomerson and Helen Hunt. No one knew Helen. She had done some small parts. And this is apropos your story about you have to look like you know what you're doing, you know. I knew what I was doing, but I was burning it at both ends. I was running Empire during the day, and I thought, I can direct this 8-day or 9, whatever it was, shoot at night, so I'll get a little sleep. I can do both, right? So by day 4 or 5, whenever it was, I knew I was really, and I have a lot of energy. I still do, thank God.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I was at the top of a building in Chinatown. Big scene for this little movie, relatively big scene. There's Tim and there's Helen, and we're all on the rooftop. The wonderful Mac Ahlberg, my DP of many years, who I miss. And anyway, we're all doing, and we did a take, we did another take. And suddenly, I wasn't conscious of the fact that I was standing up, and I fell dead asleep, standing up in the middle of all this. So my mechanism was, the minute I realized I was asleep, I shouted, and action, you know, as a command, like, you know, like I always do, and action. And everyone looked at me like, the fuck is he doing? They're still prepping, they're moving lights. So as long as you look like you know what you're doing. Anyway, all right, go Shining. A little bit about The Shining.
Well, it was really interesting because first King said, if Brian De Palma doesn't want to do this, would you direct it?
For real?
Yeah. Because he'd done Carrie and, you know.
Yeah, of course. That beautiful Pino Donaggio music. Big fan.
So great. It's just a great movie.
It's a great movie.
A great launch for De Palma and King. It made both their careers.
Yeah.
So I said, yeah, of course. And Brian De Palma didn't want to do television. So.
Interesting.
But again, they were very happy with The Stand, so they were very happy at ABC for me and King to reunite, as he was as well, because we work really well together.
Right.
So the problem was trying to find a Jack Torrance, because nobody wanted to step into Nicholson's shoes.
Wow.
I didn't realize. At first, before we were actually going, I called Gary Sinise and said, what would you think about playing Jack Torrance? And he said, you know, I'd be hesitant to step into Mr. Nicholson's shoes. And I suddenly realized, our producer, Mark Carliner, said, you know, the first line of every review is going to be, so-and-so is no Jack Nicholson.
Right. Oh, my God.
So we were in pre-production, and we were 3 days before we were supposed to start production, and we still didn't have a Jack Torrance.
Oh, my goodness.
We'd had a British actor who would have been terrific, commit to it, And then we could never get him on the phone, and we could never get him. So, so we have Rebecca De Mornay cast. She was cast immediately. King had thought of her 3 years before.
Interesting.
To have a really strong Wendy Torrance, you know, as opposed to Shelley Duvall's Olive Oil.
Right.
So we have this conundrum, and finally we contacted Steven Weber's agent, and Weber is a huge King fan, a huge horror fan, and a tremendous actor who was in a sitcom that was a big hit, and he was very successful in that.
What was that?
Wings.
Wings. Okay, sure. Yeah. Right.
So he came in and read with Rebecca and blew us all away. And all of us were glad that none of those people would dare step into the shoes.
Right.
But he was still, he still had another few days of shooting to go on his TV series.
So he moved the whole thing a bit.
We didn't. We couldn't because we were locked into locations and our production schedule and our building schedule and all of that. So we started shooting all, I started shooting all the second unit stuff, the pieces, the haunted hotel, the images and things, until he could come in.
He was ready. That's a cool story.
And yeah, and we shot at the Stanley Hotel, which is where King was inspired to write the book.
Colorado.
In Colorado, Estes Park.
I stay there.
Yeah.
We stay there.
It's an amazing place. Yeah. It's not nearly as luxurious as it seems in the movie, but... But we built a lot of sets as well, like the hallway that gets destroyed and room 217 was built and the apartment that they lived in at the hotel.
How long
built.
Are those miniseries? I don't remember. I was sort of in Italy.
That was a six-hour, but four and a half without the commercials and stuff. And we had 72 days to shoot. And of everything I've ever shot, it's the only time I felt like we had enough money. And time.
Really?
I've never, ever felt
even with the stand?
With the stand.
Well, of course, that was such a huge canvas.
It was something like 94 scripted locations. You know, we didn't go to that many places, but it was rough.
So, and The Shining was also like later in the 90s? I'm trying to remember the
time. It was 97.
97.
Shot in 96.
Okay. So now you've, and during, I mean, I always ask the most bizarre questions. I apologize.
Yeah,
so now you're a really well-paid Hollywood director. You're making these huge shows. Wasn't there anything frivolous you bought? Forget the fancy car. There must have been something bizarre. You go, I got money. I'm going to buy this thing. Because I was a big collector. I still am. So I bought artwork and original, you know, Jack Kirby. I mean, I bought artifacts that I like.
I have some original posters, but they're things like Creature from the Black Lagoon, Banner poster, and, you know, Toby's Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Repulsion, things like that.
But crazy moment where you go, God, maybe I shouldn't have spent that money on something that you would normally try to drag. That must be something.
Impossible. I'm trying to think. You know, I wanted all the best video equipment. You know, I had laser discs and a big screen TV.
Big collection of
and
laser
stuff
discs.
Like that. Right. And then DVDs and getting good quality equipment, but it's still home.
Did you buy the first flat screen when they came out 8,000 years ago?
No, because they were so expensive.
They were $25,000. Oh, so I'm. Yeah. Again, this is during a period where I had money, then I had no money. And
that was like a 55-inch, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So just for you guys who can now, for $200 or $300, buy a 55-inch flat screen. When they first came out, which was, I couldn't wait. I knew if I waited a year, it'd be less expensive. But the idea of putting this like painting on your wall with, because I had always had the crazy equipment, but the big tube and the thing or projection. It was always
three-quarter inch.
I did all that. But the idea was just so appealing that I knew the week, and I went down to, I don't know what store it was. It wasn't Good Guys. And I bought that first, the very first one. And I'm embarrassed to say it was
$25,000. Wow.
And shortly thereafter, I was broke.
Living like a mogul.
Not because of that purchase, but just because world changed.
No, I've never really done that. I mean, you know, I bought a Tesla in recent years.
Okay.
And that's like
do you like
biggest
that? Do you enjoy the Tesla?
I do, but I just think Elon Musk is a monster. So I kind of regret it now seeing where he's gone. But that's been the biggest splurge I've ever done.
That's cool. Well, I mean, I don't have one. I still have a gas guzzler because I'm just used to that.
Well, I had a Chevy Bolt before, which was also electric.
Electric, right, right. Yeah. I was laughing like a big car.
No, no. But I didn't want to.
Did you ever have a muscle car back in the 70s, like a big?
No, I was not a car guy.
Okay. I wasn't a supercar guy, but there's something about back then being a young kid and driving a car with 8 billion horsepower.
When I was a kid, I couldn't afford anything like that.
Well, that's right. Your thing turned in your 30s.
Yeah. So my stepfather gave me a primer gray 52 Chevy for my 16th birthday. So that was what I drove until I bought myself a 63 Rambler wagon.
Okay, you know, that was a big...
It was whatever I could get for the best price for a couple
of
blew
some
bucks.
Of those up for crash.
Yeah, I don't doubt
there's
it.
There's no question about
it. And deservedly so.
No, those are all fun, ridiculous cars. Okay, now we got to segue into a series that I absolutely loved. I've seen, I think, every one of them. So how did Masters of Horror kind of come into being?
We had a series of dinners. A lot of us in the genre, including you, and when there is a next one, if we ever have one, you're going to be there. We'd meet each other at DGA meetings or conventions
or festivals.
I
hate that. I'll have a private dinner with you and our respective, but I just don't put me in a room with other people. I'm bad that way.
Well,
I don't like
it.
Just the thought of a union or a group of people and –
Yeah, but that's how we would meet, would be at film festivals or
whatever. Who are the we? Give me a
The we, people like John Carpenter, who I worked with doing publicity, but Toby Hooper I met on the set of Poltergeist doing publicity. And
So you would have sort of a director's
enclave. Yeah,
horror directors.
It was like the club. And so I would put together dinners. The first one, there was a dozen of us. It took me a week to get the set up, to get everybody's schedule straight. And we had such a good time that the next one took me an hour of phone calls.
How cool
but
is
the
that?
First one, it was me, John Landis, Wes Craven, Stuart Gordon, Toby Hooper, John Carpenter, Guillermo del Toro.
Wow.
I mean, there were 12 of us. Bill Malone, Tommy McLaughlin.
Do you have pictures from that gathering?
Yeah, there are pictures.
Send me a picture.
Okay.
I'll just keep it private, but I'd love to see that picture.
Yeah, it's on my Facebook
probably page. Probably 15 years ago or whatever.
Yeah, even older. It was before that because Masters of Horror started in 2005. So it would have been a year or two before that. And each one grew exponentially. But at the very first one, it was at a restaurant in the Valley.
Which restaurant?
Don't
worry.
It's still there. I just can't think of the name of it right now.
Okay.
But there were a dozen of us. And at the table next to us, there was a party having a birthday celebration. And so after their dinner, they sang Happy Birthday, and we stood up and joined in.
Okay.
And at the very end of it, Guillermo stands up and says, "The Masters of Horror wish you a happy birthday." And so that we thought that name would be great. So I took the idea of what if the inmates were in charge of the asylum?
Right, right.
And the filmmakers could make what they make the way they want to make it with no interference.
Right, right.
And so we pitched it to three places. One of them was Anchor Bay.
Okay.
And in the room, they said, "How much and when can we start?"
That's great.
So they would have funded the whole thing.
Almost a no-brainer. But
but it was a chicken and egg. I had to make sure, yes, these people would be interested, but will they commit to it on paper?
Right,
that if they're available, they'll do this TV show.
Right, right.
So they did. And John Hyde at Anchor Bay, he got it. He bought it in the room. And they were going to make it even without the network commitment because Showtime wasn't looking for a show, but they only paid 10% of the budget to license the show.
Oh, wow.
So they had no say, and we were in control. And so all of these people, you know, Carpenter and Toby, who'd been shat on by the studios, were able to exercise their muscles at full power, and they did. You know, we didn't have a lot of time, didn't have a lot of money.
Were these hour shows? Do I remember correctly?
Yeah.
I love that hour. That's everything's an
hour.
The hour
is great. You can do a three-act story.
You can,
hour.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And we
there
got
is a shorter attention span as well these days.
And it was for television.
Right.
But, you know, we got Dario Argento and we got Takashi Miike and we just got so
fantastic.
Many.
Fantastic. No, that was such
people.
A terrific show. Where was it broadcast? I don't even remember.
Showtime.
Was it Showtime?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then I remember getting some of them on video later on DVD or whatever it was.
The only complete set on Blu-ray is a German collection.
Yeah, of course. That makes sense.
But they put out, Anchor Bay put out some like 2 and 3 on a disc,
right.
But not all of them. And they were in 1080i, not 1080p.
Okay. So how many did you wind up doing?
We did two seasons of 13 a season. Wow. So we did 26.
That was a terrific show. Well
thank
done.
You.
And
thank
you would think that would have interesting that group of people, but that this would have continued in a way, because it has such a, I mean, nothing's hotter now than horror. I mean, horror has always had an audience, but you know, it's really. Look at what people are going to see.
And Guillermo now has his own show, The Cabinet of Curiosities, which is his Masters of Horror.
Well, he's going to be in here soon, so we look forward to
he's such a great guy.
Grande Guillermo.
Yes, yeah. But, it was a great experience. We were a little ahead of our time.
Yeah, I think you're right about
that. And the company was
that.
Bought. Lionsgate bought it.
Right, right.
And so they asked Showtime to double their commitment.
Right.
And Showtime said, nah, we don't. We were their second highest rated show on Showtime.
Really?
After Dexter.
Mm-hmm.
With no promotion.
Right, right.
And so they said, well, we're going to take it to NBC because there was a writer's strike coming along and they wanted to do a strike-proof show. Well, we weren't a strike-proof show with me in charge.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so they sold it to NBC as Fear Itself, which I gave the name to. And I was going to be the showrunner. But when they sold it to NBC, I said, I can't do this. We're going to have sponsors. We're going to have network standards and practices.
Right.
There's no way
which
we
you're very familiar with.
Yes. But there's no way we could give these directors this freedom that they'd had.
Right.
So I said, I talked to the guys and said, I'm leaving. I can't do it this way. And Stuart is the one who talked me into staying. He said, look how great Twilight Zone and Outer Limits were in their day. Mm. We can do this.
Interesting.
And I said, all right, let's do it. And we had 13 scripts written. And then the writer's strike happened.
Mm.
And I said, I'm leaving. I can't stay.
Right.
And one of the producers said, oh, you can oversee these writers, these non-union writers that they hired who had done work on another show that they'd kind of stolen, Masters of Science Fiction. And they were my managers.
Fuckers. I mean bastards.
So they hired non-union writers.
Right.
And I said, I'm not going to be a guy who tells them what to write and not be able to do it myself.
Sure, sure.
So, you know, they basically kind of kidnapped my baby.
I hear you. Well, that sucks. Well, again, welcome to Hollywood. It's just
I would rather revel in the 26 great shows we did than mourn what we didn't, because there's a chance the quality
might
have slid.
You know, we're just starting off, you and I, in this business. We're just, we're just beginning to rock, so there's many years ahead, and the world, the landscape changes so rapidly, that, and I think because horror is so in vogue and young kids want to go see horror and have fun, and which is great, I mean, not to talk about the I don't ever talk about politics, but the politics of, you know, who's going to the movie theater anymore, you know, what age group, you know, and I mean, I don't have to talk about it. People know they can read, and, you know, when you have a movie like Amsterdam come out, which I could not wait to see, and no one showed up.
No one.
I mean, you have to wonder, okay, so everyone knows that. They're thinking about it.
But at least horror is back on the big screen.
It is huge.
It's the one thing, even if it dips in popularity, you know it's going to come back.
Because
it doesn't rely on stars.
Right.
It's about stories, and people want the communal experience.
But it brings young people into the theater.
Right.
You know, they want to go and have a good time there. They want to make out with the chick, whatever their thoughts are, or whoever's making out with whoever. They are it's an event for them, you know.
Exactly.
And, of course, when Avatar 2 comes out, it'll be a massive event.
Yeah, I mean, it's Marvel and horror are basically what's happening now. And we'll see about Avatar.
So, therefore, with these massive streaming sites and everything that's going on, I think the appetite for exactly what you did so well 10, 15 years ago with Masters of Horror.
Thank you.
Maybe reconfigured in some way. And that's what you and I should talk about.
Well,
after we wrap, because...
Well, many people are doing it now. Guillermo's got his show. American Horror Story is anthological in that it's a new story every season.
Right.
And Creepshow and...
But there's always a new spin. There's always a new way to direct it. And I think we have to look at who the audience primarily is and then figure it out.
Yeah.
You and I are going to talk about this.
All right.
I was going to say over a vodka martini, but what do you – I mean, I never did drugs. I'm happy about that. I do have a drink. So what – you don't drink booze?
No, I never have.
Okay. That's totally cool. I never smoked a cigarette.
Same here.
I don't do drugs, but I do like a glass – mainly a glass of wine. I mean, I grew up in that.
You're Italian.
You can't. Yeah. I'm not Italian. I just grew up there.
Yeah, but you grew up there.
So what do you – but you – what do you do to relax? Do you what do you have, you know, like a lemonade or what do you do?
I like a good oat milk chai latte.
No, but at the end of the day when you want to chill out.
Well, basically – Cynthia and I will watch a movie or there's such great television now.
Great television.
That it's
better
than
I could rattle
movies.
Off 10 shows. Really great. And look, they have the budgets now, insane budgets.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Guillermo's budget is easily – it's got to be 5 or 10 times what Masters of Horror was.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, they
have crazy
unlimited
numbers.
Money.
These are crazy, crazy numbers that I can't even
– ours were $2 million an episode, and the average
– 2 million?
Yeah.
Okay, honestly, that freaks me out because that's
that it was so much.
That it was so much
for you, but that's
for me,
an all union show.
That's 10 movies. And
it's a network union show.
I get it.
At that time, the average network TV show cost 3 to 4.
Back 15 whatever years ago,
and we were
that
doing it for two.
I don't even know. I wouldn't know how to even spend that money.
I'll bet you would.
No, I wouldn't. I would have no clue. Well, okay,
cast,
but a lot of times the cast are. I want to say unknowns. They're good.
The buildings of the sets and the locations.
Yeah, well, why build? You can find all this stuff. I'm shooting.
Yeah, but
movies.
There are some things you have to.
No, of course. Yeah. But I'm shooting amazingly well-appointed movies in Cleveland, Ohio. I stumbled on a location. I bought a house that was built at the beginning of the last century.
It's your Bray Studios.
It's we call it the Full Moon Manor. Okay, it's 10,000 square feet. We've shot 11 movies there. You would never know. I mean, we go outside to shoot some stuff.
Well, you're doing what Hammer did at Bray.
And it works beautifully, and it looks amazing. You go, wow, look at that gorgeous set. And it's like, and to think that I built sets like that, not even looking that good in Italy in the 80s, you know.
Yeah.
We spent real money, you know, 100 grand to build the interior of Dolls or one of Stewart's movies, more probably. So it depends how you approach it. So I think there's a new spin to all this. And on that note, I want to say that you've been an awesome dude. I love and we bump into each other at airports
it's
and
always
on a plane, wherever it is.
In Mexico.
You're right.
And
what was it?
That was
I forget the name of that. Yeah.
Mexico. Not Morbido, the other
one. I think it was Morbido.
Yeah, it was Morbido.
Morbido. Anyway, we will do this again. It's been so
great
talking to you. And we will definitely conjure up some ideas because it's all about a new spin, a new idea. You know?
Absolutely.
I mean, if you look back at you've been a fan of horror, so I probably have the same amount of time. I think
my whole life.
My whole life. Okay. Yeah. That's why I wanted to make
horror
movies.
We're about the same age, I think.
Well, I'm in my 30s. Okay.
Yeah.
No, that's
denial. Okay, I'm 42.
No, we are probably about the same age. But if one thing is for sure, things do shift and change, and you look back and go, wow, look at what's going on today. No one would have thought of this 20 years ago.
And a lot of us have not been able to keep maintaining a career throughout all of these metamorphoses.
Right, that is true. Well, because you've had we're getting back into dialogue, which I love. You've had a career that has spanned and spawned into mainstream.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. My first job was for Steven Spielberg.
Okay. I can't claim any of that.
Yeah.
I've been in my own bubble.
But then I've gone the opposite route into independence.
I know.
Like Nightmare Cinema.
But I'm saying you've had that experience. You've worked with Stephen King and Spielberg. You've had that. I've not had that. I've literally existed in this exact same bubble making kind of the same size movies. First, they were theatrically released. That was the whole world. Then there was Betamax and VHS, and then we morphed into DVDs, and then Blockbuster and Hollywood died and closed, and it was the worst, and we were almost broke, and then streaming started up. So you look back, you go, wow, you know. Now,
but
luckily,
you've spent all that time in control of your destiny.
That is true. That is true.
You've been the boss. I would hate to be a businessman. I think I would be really bad at it.
No,
I'm very practical in real life.
But you're conservative. Come on.
But I am, the one way I'm conservative is fiscally.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, no. But that's important, too.
But I would not want to make business decisions like you make every single day. And again, you've created, I mean, empire is the word you called your company, but right. It is a true empire of your own that you sit at the top of that planet.
Well, it's a little planet.
Okay, it's a moon.
It's king of the ants. I think that's what this is.
Speaking
exactly.
Speaking of Stuart.
Speaking of Stuart. Yeah. We'll do this again.
All right.
Thank you, Mick.
That was great.
Ciao.
Thank
cameras.
You.
Thanks, guys. Okay, that's it for this week. Remember to follow The Freak Show for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts from. And be sure to watch our video version of the show on Full Moon Features and Full Moon's Amazon Prime channel. See you dudes next time.